From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Emergency, everybody to get from street. Emergency, everybody to get from street.
That was a clip from the 1965 comedy movie The Russians Are Coming, made at the height of the Cold War in 1965.
Emergency, everybody to get from street.
A half century later, and a quarter of a century after the fall of the Soviet Union, fear of Russia appears to be on the rise, at least in political campaigns.
Were you suggesting that Putin would rather see him as president than you?
Well, I'm not going to jump to that conclusion, but I think laying out the facts raises serious issues about Russian interference in our elections, in our democracy. And for Trump to both encourage that and to praise Putin, despite what appears to be a deliberate effort to try to affect the election, I think raises national security issues.
This past Thursday in Philadelphia at the DNC, we spoke with Peter Laveau, the host of Crosstalk from RT, about the view of the doings in Philadelphia and Cleveland from Moscow. Peter, glad to have you back. Really want to get your perspective on what's happening here at the DNC and earlier at the RNC from the way it seems from we're sitting in Moscow.
Well, you know, the election campaign and carnival in the United States is seen for what it is in Russia. I have to tell your listeners that from the Russian perspective, and the political elite here and the establishment and the average person, they don't see huge differences between the political parties, between Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah.
They just don't see the difference. I mean, they see a lot of hostility from both parties. But lo and behold, and a lot of people here were really quite shocked that Russia was going to be pulled, and its president pulled right into the center of all of this about the alleged Russian hacking of the Democratic National Committee's emails. I'm not going to say one way or another if it's true or not. I mean, intelligence agencies around the world hack each other all the time. I mean, I don't know why anyone is surprised by that and how it's going to be used. Hillary Clinton is the one that put a spin on it. I think that's why Bill Clinton is still on the payroll. I mean, you know, as much as I have disdain for Bill Clinton, he's an amazing politician, and I'm sure it was his idea to put this spin. But it doesn't bode well. Russia doesn't have a stake in this at all. It doesn't have any one opinion or another on this election. It's so far away and so distant, and Americans tend to think that they're so exceptionally important in what they do. It's not true from the outside. What's going to happen, Clinton or Trump, is going to be more or less the same. That's at least the opinion on this side of the pond.
You know, it was interesting to hear the interview with Bashar al-Assad a week or two ago, where he was asked by some guy from NBC about this, and you know, what do you think of the U.S. elections? And he said, I don't think about the U.S. elections. He said, everything that goes on during that bears no relationship whatsoever to the actual policy established by whoever wins. And so, you know, January 20th, you have a new president. We'll see the new policy after that. Ask me then.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that this ridiculous PR campaign trying to taint a Trump with Putin, Donald Trump, as far as I can tell, Don, hasn't made a dime or even a buck in Russia. Hillary Clinton's husband, Bill Clinton, came to Russia and got a really fat check for Renaissance Bank for speaking fees and probably, quote unquote, doing some fixing. So if anyone in this campaign has made a buck off, as far as the candidates are concerned or related to the candidates, it's the Clinton camp and not Donald Trump. Why, if you step back, Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump made two pro forma complimentary statements about each other. Now, as far as I'm concerned, if we dig deep into the archives, I'm sure Vladimir Putin and Foreign Minister Lavrov have said complimentary things about Hillary Clinton. And I have to ask, you know, our listeners here, I mean, Starbucks is in Russia. Is Putin controlling Starbucks? Audi's in Russia. Is he controlling Audi? And again, even in this these ridiculous articles coming out of Think Tankistan, as I call it, in the U.S., Putin's Deutsche Bank. Well, Deutsche Bank has left Russia. It's not even operating in Russia anymore because they had some Russian clients that they weren't very happy with, and they did the right thing, and they pulled the rug. You have these people that are just so ill-informed, so deeply prejudiced, that they'll just do a quick search on Google. Yeah, Deutsche Bank and Russia and investors in Russia have had a lot of contact. It hasn't always been good. But at the same time, Donald Trump doesn't have a lot of good contacts with Wall Street. So I don't know really what the real spin here is, except for taint someone through alleged relations with a foreign power.
Yeah, I mean, it's to call it McCarthy-esque is...
Yeah.
It's self-cliched. It's so obviously pulling at the heartstrings of, you know, people who remember the Cold War and have some, you know, latent hostility towards Russia, and no other, it serves no other purpose.
Well, the interesting thing is that I'm not particularly convinced it's going to have a whole lot of traction. I do a lot of traveling through Western Europe and the UK, and I don't see this hostility towards Putin in Russia that we're so told about in Western media. Now, you can tell me what the situation is in the States, because I don't travel there very often because it's so far away from me. But it's just the political class and their client media, the echo chamber, that constantly talks about this. I don't see it has traction on the ground. As a matter of fact, and maybe our listeners will be a little bit surprised, I've come across people that are a great admirer of Vladimir Putin because he's just a leader. He sticks up for his country. You may not always agree with what he says or what he does, but at least he's a leader. When you look at the kind of quote-unquote leadership coming out of the United States, it's completely void. I mean, the fact of the matter is, let's stay with the real story. Hillary Clinton, her machine with her husband, and the Democratic Party have shown to be exactly what you and I have been saying for a long time, corrupt to its very, very core.
Yep.
And I'm very disappointed with Bernie Sanders. Personally, I'm very disappointed. I don't agree with him on every point, but the issue of social justice has come back on the agenda, and I expect him to do his job. And he stepped back, and I hope he will have another agenda to get back into the spotlight and lead this movement of social justice. And that is not about being left or right. It's about being morally right for the people of the United States and the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of people here disappointed about that, and particularly the way that he did it, which actually interferes with some folks that are trying to get some of the things that were done that were illegal and or immoral undone, particularly the litigation, looking to go deep into some of the elections that could have reversed the delegate allocation and perhaps even the outcome of the ballot that was held yesterday by doing it by acclamation, so that the up and down vote was irrelevant, it was by acclamation. Consequently, no matter how the delegate count would have been allocated by the litigation, you would have had the same outcome. Consequently, it's moot.
Well, you know, Don, you're much closer to it than I am, obviously. But it seems to me that this whole process in capturing the nomination continues to delegitimize Hillary Clinton as a candidate.
Yep.
I mean, we have a long history of deception, of lies. And again, in front of everyone, in front of the American people and anyone that was watching abroad, look at the audience. Who was in the audience in that convention hall? A lot of people walked out, and God bless them, okay?
Yeah.
Because they had something stolen from them, their votes, and do it by the rules. And by the rules, whoever gets the most votes and does it by the rules, then fine, even if I don't agree with them. But this behind-the-scenes manipulations and machinations, I think says a whole lot about the Democratic Party and the state of it. And again, and from my own personal observation here, it seems to me Hillary Clinton's very much like Richard Nixon.
Yeah.
And Bill Clinton has probably coached her. She is trying to seize the center and move to the right. And that's in the Democratic Party itself has surrendered a great deal of its ethics and its moral code. And that's only for electioneering, to be elected. But that is abandoning what the Democratic Party, the party of FDR, the party of Lyndon Baines Johnson, you know, if you don't want that, then go ahead and join the Republican Party, I say. But don't destroy the party for the electability of one person. And I think that's a truly tragic event for the American political spectrum, because now we have no political spectrum. It's only about power and the ambitions of individuals.
You know, one of the things that's most troubling to me is that the entire group of people that helped organize Sanders' campaign and you know, launched it, pushed it, drove it to the convention, essentially, where there was new blood that was needed to come into the Democratic Party and try to revive it from the inside. And they have been thoroughly betrayed in front of the whole world on television. And they have a very palpable sense of that. You could see it in their faces. I spoke with a number of them. That's how they were depressed, crying, angry. Now, I mean, this whole group of people that have been, you know, there's three movements that we calculate here, the people that, you know, that have been supporting Trump, the people that were supporting Sanders, and the people that are in the streets, Black Lives Matter and such. And, you know, you have had this whole betrayal take place in front of them, conducted by Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party. And it's just, I don't know where politics goes from here. It's very troubling.
Well, let's take virtue from necessity. I think this is an interesting epiphany, I would say, in American politics, because now the disappointed people within the big tent of the Democratic Party, and I'm looking at progressives and I'm looking at more left-wing people, independents here, it's time to take the reins. It's time to stop complaining, and stop being outraged, and to start putting a movement together. We've seen this in American history before. We saw in 1964 with the Goldwater collapse here, and the Republicans got themselves together. This happened also in 1972. You know, when the Democrats had to learn, you know, that they had to have some their own vision here. When you're trying to copy or mimic your opposition, you're going to lose. Margaret Thatcher taught that to us very, very well. When the Labour Party tried to move to the right, she crushed them. Okay, right. And this is what's going to happen again. What Hillary Clinton, whatever her prospects are, getting the White House or not, she has destroyed the Democratic Party. And take virtue from necessity here. It's time for the Democratic Party to have a new vision. The millennials have so many great ideas. It's so refreshing that young people, and I used to teach at the University of California, they were apolitical. They were MTV people. They were lifestyle people. They were very specific on cultural issues here. But now, from what I've seen from a distance, is this is a defining moment where politics actually becomes to matter again. And I think this is, we have to take this dark moment and look that there is light at the end of the tunnel, but it's up to them to do it, because everything is used against them. The corporate media, my goodness, I watch it all the time because I have to be prepared for crosstalk. I watch CNN, I watch BBC, I watch Fox TV. Oh my goodness, how it is stacked against any kind of political mobilization, and that's including in Europe, the UK, and the United States. The odds are against us hugely, but we have an opportunity because it's plain to see, just as you pointed out.
You know, and there is, you mentioned going across Europe, for example. You've had, just in the last two or three years, you've had the election of Syriza, I mean, with all the contradictions. You've had the Brexit vote. You've had Trump winning a primary against essentially the entire Republican Party establishment, for whatever he is. That fact is there, and it's the result of a public, you know, swelling, you know, of an uprising essentially among the constituents of the party. The Democratic Party, that particular uprising was just smothered, and at some point, I assume that means the collapse of the Democratic Party, you know, structure itself, like basically it's starving itself to death of new blood. But what is it that people can be doing inside the Democratic Party, like now, while we're at the convention and going forward, to try to make that actually happen so that it doesn't get reconstituted into exactly what it was?
Well, number one, and I know a lot of people will really very much adamantly, vehemently disagree with me, I take the position of don't vote. I'm sorry. This process is so rigged. It's so tainted. You know, people always say you have to participate to be part of the process to change it. We're at a dead end right now. I don't think you should participate in this. You legitimize this corrupt process. I'll say something that may really surprise you. I think it's time for disaffected Democrats, particularly young people and progressives. They need to sit down and talk to some Trump people, because they're not necessarily pro-Donald Trump. They are pro this uprising, this insurrection. And I think, you know, and I'm going to borrow a phrase, and I'm almost embarrassed to use it, because I remember Hillary Clinton used it when she was campaigning to become a senator for New York, you know, to go on a talking tour. Right. I mean, I think we need to start talking to each other a lot more, because we've been divided so much by the corporate media. We've been defined. We've been put labels on all of us. I bet you, Don, I bet you if we had a bigger, longer, more tolerant conversation, we have a lot more in common than you think.
Yeah.
And I think the insurrection in the Republican Party, forget about Donald Trump. I'm not interested in him at all.
Right.
Some of the things that he says about foreign policy, I agree with. I'm not necessarily convinced they're actually his own ideas.
Right.
I go back to the article in the National Interest that you and I had a conversation with a few weeks ago. But I think we have to look at the insurrectional elements in both parties, and it's an opportunity for both parties to reinvent themselves. Again, let's not dwell on Donald Trump as a candidate, because, you know, you and I know that he's all over the map, and I think that's a reflection of how much people are really angry in the Republican Party, because they don't see the Republican Party serving their needs, just like a lot of people in the Democratic Party don't see the leadership of their party serving their needs. So this is an interesting moment. And I think that we have to get beyond the establishment, the donor block that controls so much, and start looking at each other and with a little bit more patience and taking a step back and maybe counting to 10 once in a while.
Yeah, you know, along those lines, when I went to Cleveland, I was prepared to see, you know, maniacs with tattoos and skinheads and Nazi flags and insignia and rebel flags and all this stuff, and some very angry people trying to bully their way around. And in fact, that is not at all what I saw. And after settling in, I started meeting people and talking with them and asking them questions. And I finally distilled it down to this question that I ended up asking hundreds of people over the course of the 4 days there. And that was essentially, if Trump weren't the Republican candidate and Bernie Sanders were the Democratic candidate, who would you vote for? Now, these are Republican prime voters, mostly Republican, you know, small town officials and party
officials.
And going
to the convention.
And at the convention.
Go ahead.
And they said they would vote for Bernie Sanders, of course. And I'd ask why. And they hit the same issues that Bernie Sanders and Trump have in common. And that is essentially, this guy's going to get me a job. And that takes place in the backdrop of, in Cleveland, like, you know, New York. If you walk along in Manhattan, you see as a backdrop the Palisades. In California, you've got either the Pacific Ocean or the, you know, Palisades, depending on where you are in California, the mountains on the other side. There are abandoned factories that loom over the city as the backdrop.
Yeah.
The factories where they used to work, the factories where their parents worked, the factories where they made things and they improved their lives and they provided for their families, and they sit there idle. And these people sit there for years with no hope. They now feel empowered. And that is something that they have in common and they see in Sanders as much as they saw it in Trump's campaign.
It's really interesting, because I think that it really gets down to what the country is supposed to mean and what it should mean, because the country's gone off course so badly over the last 40 years, and it's been hijacked. It's been hijacked. Bernie Sanders could say that. He did say that. Donald Trump can say that. He does say that. And I think that's where we start beginning to connect the dots here. We're going to disagree fundamentally in a lot of issues, but I think it's really about the destiny of what the country is all about, and even about the American identity. And I don't see the elites in the Republican Party and the elites in the Democratic Party really in tune with that anymore. They're far more interested in their own interests, and they actually work in collusion with each other. Look at the most notorious neocons of the Republican Party. Who are they supporting in this election?
Right.
Hillary Clinton.
Right.
That says everything right there. So you're not ideologically driven, okay? You're about power, and you want only power, and you'll only serve the person that will give you that power. Hillary Hillary Clinton has compromised herself in the eyes of so many people in the elite. You look at the National Security State, at the NSA, you look at the FBI, I'm talking about her email scandal, the
right.
first one. Okay.
Right.
I mean, she is so compromised by all of these people. I mean, she will, if she is elected, she will be the most compromised, weak president that we could ever possibly imagine. Because, you know, it's like J. Edgar Hoover when he used to go in front of Congress. And I don't know if our listeners know this, but every time he tried to get an increase with the FBI's budget, he brought these huge troves of files with him. And anytime a congressman gave him any trouble, he would just randomly go into his briefcase, and then he would put it on his table talking to Congress in public.
Right.
So, Congressman Smith, you wanted to ask me about what? And he opens the file. Oh, well, J. Edgar Hoover got what he wanted.
Right, that's right. You know, and that's the point. You know, the for better or worse, what happened inside the Republican Party sent the elite scurrying, and they're now surrounding the elite and Clinton in the Democratic Party. The Republican Party's elite was driven out by the insurgency. The Democratic Party elite is firmly in control, has attempted to in any event, and in the main squashed the insurgency and is doing it in tandem with the former Republican Party elite.
Well, the interesting thing is, again, you know, this is what makes Donald Trump such a wild card, because I don't think he, at least the way I read him, is I don't think he really understands the kind of rage that he is riding on top of. I think the man is an egomaniac, and I don't think he's a. I mean, if you look at his entire business history, if you've been in bed with him in business, you don't always, or actually quite often, don't get a good part of the deal. And so he's riding on top of something that I think is really powerful, and I think it's positive, because there's a whole lot of questioning within the party itself, because the Republican Party has betrayed so many vested core interests of what the American people want. And you've mentioned it. It's always about one thing, and that's what you and I have absolute agreement on. It's about jobs.
Right.
What am I supposed to do in this country? I mean, you want me to wave the flag. You want me to give my blood in foreign wars. You want to drain my income fighting wars that I don't need. You take my tax money from me. My kids can't go to school. When they get an education, they can't get a job because they're not properly trained for the economy. And they want you to go into this incredible debt slavery. I mean, this is where the Republicans and the Democrats have so much in common. And these are the issues that we need to reach out to each other.
That's right.
Because that's what it's all about. I don't like to obliterate these important, you know, jobs. You know, we all need to make money, okay? And once we're all, you know, fat, happy, and satisfied, then we can talk about the nuances of life. And that's my cultural conservatism. Because if I feel confident with myself and my environment and my community, then I feel I can be confident in my politics. But if I don't have a job, or I have only a service job and I'm paying taxes for
right.
things that I have absolutely no control of, you know, that makes me angry. And I think that goes across the political spectrum.
You know what? Along that same lines, and I don't know that we necessarily disagree. We might on fine detail, but in the main, those jobs, the people that are coal miners, people that are, you know, working oil rigs, all of that, those jobs go through a vigorous, rigorous environmental review process that always, by the way, is pretty much rigged literally for, you know, big business here in the United States. But in any event, they go through an environmental review. The financing of, say, tearing up the entire ocean floor to capture oil for some company that's going to put a gazillion dollars in some Wall Street investment firm's pocket, however, never gets that kind of an environmental review. Those jobs, in other words, are not subject to public scrutiny or looking at the output from the programs and think practices that they conduct. But those things that affect working people are put to the most rigorous, standard of review, and consequently, they get the short end of the stick all the time.
No, it's you're absolutely right, because a lot of my critics are very surprised with me, because I am not pro-capitalism. Either indifferent or hostile to it, because I believe in economy for people. I don't believe in an ideology.
Right. Right.
I believe in an economy that works for people. Now, if you can call it whatever ism you want, and I don't really care about the labels you put on it. Right. But I will not buy into an ideology that doesn't work for the people. I mean, I perfectly accept that there will be wealthy people in the world, and I have nothing against that. But I do have a big problem if wealthy people become very, very wealthy at the expense of everyone else. And I think that's a very simple way of understanding what politics should be about. That's what politics should be about, is creating a better social community for all to participate with a gazillion different points of view. And that's what makes people stronger. The way politics is projected in the United States is that either you're for something or you're hostile, and you're treated as being marginalized and ghettoized. I mean, just about every single social group outside of power is ghettoized one way or another. Right. And it's like, go ahead, fight each other right now. Right. And that's, again, I go back to the insurrections in both parties. It's time to stop listening to these moneyed elites and the donor elites and give us all a breath of fresh air. Because this is tragic. I mean, again, you know, Donald Trump is too much of a great unknown for me to be trustworthy. And Hillary Clinton is known for what she is.
Right.
She is corrupt to the core.
Peter, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Don, I'm always very happy to be on your program.
Thanks, brother. I appreciate it. Take care of yourself.
Okay, all right.
And now for some political commentary from BlackAgendaReport.com's Glenn Ford.
Ben Jealous looks so happy to be on the prime time stage at the Democratic National Convention Monday night, thrilled to be endorsing Hillary Clinton for president. Jealous got to the convention as one of Bernie Sanders' high-profile black supporters, a position he took to ensure that the black misleadership class was represented everywhere within the Democratic Party, including its insurgent wing. The NAACP, which Jealous led for 4 years, is a virtual annex of the Democratic Party. But since Jealous was no longer president of the organization, it was safe for him to temporarily join the Sanders camp, with confidence that Bernie would at some point capitulate, and they could all be welcomed back into the bosom of corporate power, personified by Hillary Clinton. You could see the utter joy in Jealous's face, like he was coming in from the cold. One of his next steps was the studios of Democracy Now!, where he flaunted his utter subservience to the Democratic Party in a debate with the Green Party's presumed presidential candidate, Jill Stein. Jealous sneered at the very idea of challenging the Democrats at the presidential level. "We cannot afford to end up with having an Iraq war because we narrowly lose the White House, as we did with Bush," said Jealous, repeating the old canard that Ralph Nader threw the 2000 election to the Republicans, and ignoring the fact that Hillary Clinton supported Bush's war in Iraq, and that Clinton and Barack Obama have since set the whole of the Middle East and much of Africa on fire. Jealous said his mission is to keep the madman and neo-fascist Donald Trump out of the White House, to which Jill Stein replied, "Hillary Clinton's finger on the button is as dangerous as Donald Trump, and it's Barack Obama himself who initiated the new nuclear arms race, spending $1 trillion. Ben Jealous could muster no substantive response to Stein on issues of war and peace or on domestic issues either. The black misleadership class is not concerned with policy, but with their own position in the Democratic Party structure, which is their doorway to Wall Street and the ruling class. Jealous shamelessly parroted the insane line that Hillary Clinton is a fierce advocate for women and for children, when, as Jill Stein reminded him, Bill and Hillary Clinton destroyed the Aid to Families with Dependent Children program, welfare as we knew it. Jealous said he was rooted in a black community that's been devastated by mass incarceration, as if Bill and Hillary were not the architects of the biggest surge in black imprisonment in history. Ben Jealous doesn't know what a fascist is and could care less. He only knows that his job is to keep black people inside Hillary Clinton's big corporate tent. He slanders leftists like Jill Stein as giving aid and comfort to Donald Trump, but makes his own career of delivering black people into the clutches of the worst mass murderers and mass incarcerators the Democratic Party has to offer. What is truly anathema to Ben Jealous and his ilk is a reemergence of a black independent politics that would likely be more radical and more socialist than Bernie Sanders or Jill Stein, and would put black misleaders like him out of business. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar, back in New York. Thanks for listening.